Please silence all electronic devices.
I'm sorry, folks. I don't trust them. And our folks don't trust them.
There is a great deal of overreaction from those who are criticizing this legislation. They will see me in court. You know, if the General Assembly were really trying to do a power grab, there's a lot of things the General Assembly could do, and we weren't.
And they don't have a very good track record there.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the 4th Estate Chambers in the bowels of your legislature, this is the WNC Politics Podcast. I'm Jeff Tiberi. It is Thursday, May 2nd, 2019. Chatting today about proposed budgets, teachers in red, and special congressional elections. Fellow legislative reporter Rusty Jacobs here to help sift through some of what was feels like a really cluttered week here in North Carolina politics. Hello, Rusty.
Jeff, how are you?
Doing all right. Let's start with the budget, the singularly most significant thing that legislators do each year. Just some friendly context for the listener here. We are on the House side right now. This began with the largely symbolic proposal from the governor. That comes first. This year, it's the House that goes and then the Senate. Sometimes it's the other way around. We think that the Senate will approve its spending plan in a couple of weeks. After that, spending compromise gets worked out between the two chambers behind closed doors. That's what we call a conference report. From there, it goes to the governor, and we will be in some sort of deadlock or standoff for a to-be-determined amount of time after the governor vetoes this budget, which we fully expect to happen. So as you and I are sitting here on a Thursday afternoon, this is all to say it's a fluid process. They've gone through, I don't know, probably 35 or 40 amendments on the House budget at this point. What, if anything, is, I mean, we talk about the big numbers the teacher raises, the overall spend. What, if anything, has caught your eye or your ear as it pertains to this specific budget proposal, which, again, reminder, sorry to beat a dead horse, is not the final budget. There are going to be a lot of changes.
Right. And I want to go back to something you said in the prelude, and that is, you know, Representative Jackson, House Democratic leader.
Yeah. Wake County.
Made a motion to refer this bill back to a health committee to insert the signature, one of the signature Democratic issues, Medicaid expansion. Now, it was pretty clear that he was not going to successfully tilt that windmill, but he made the motion. What's interesting about it is in his argument for stopping debate on the overall budget, getting that provision inserted into it and then bringing it back for debate, is he saying, look, this year, guys, I mean, he didn't say this explicitly, but this year, the governor can possibly successfully veto the budget. Why put off the debate that we're going to have later as opposed to doing it right now? And some of his, you know, fellow Democratic members backed him up on that. But it was interesting that he seized on that as the argument, not so much about the policy itself, but
right.
Like, we're going to have this debate.
Right.
Let's do it now.
That obviously did not advance. Jackson tries to send the budget back through a different committee because Medicaid is going to be such a central part of when lawmakers actually go home for the year, if and when they do go home for the year. Why didn't this work, this maneuver? Who was opposed? I mean, the Republicans were opposed to it, but why?
Well, I mean, they're going to stick to their concerns. That is, I mean, you know, Representative Jackson did point out there are some Republicans. I mean, he gave a number, but there's a fair number of Republicans that put their own Medicaid expansion.
Right.
I think it was Donnie Lambeth,
mm-hmm.
who was the chief sponsor of that bill,
yep.
Put that forward. So he's saying, look, there could be some middle ground. He said in his argument, he said, let's get some Medicaid in some form or in some fashion, some sort of Medicaid expansion in. We've got a number of people on both sides of the aisle who want to do something. Let's do it now as opposed to later when it's going to be, you know, Robert Reeves, Democratic leaders in the in the House said, you know, basically, I like you all, but I don't want to spend Christmas with you. You know, let's do cards instead of handshakes. Again, the argument that we're going to have the debate, let's do it now. But the Republicans continue to say, while the Democrats say right now, the federal government would foot most of the bill for Medicaid expansion. Who knows what could happen with recessions?
That's one of the concerns,
and
right.
that it might end up being the state that pays for it.
Right, and I believe, not looking at Medicaid notes, but it's a 90-10 split. One of the concerns from some conservatives is that the federal government could roll back the portion of which it pays into Medicaid. 36 states have expanded Medicaid and the District of Columbia. So North Carolina is in a minority of states that has not expanded Medicaid, and that is a central issue. And we've talked about it on the podcast as well. We've both reported on it. It's a central issue to Governor Cooper's agenda. It would become obviously a piece of policy, depending on how it was laid out, that would affect hundreds of thousands of people, which is tangible and certainly noteworthy. It's also something that Governor Cooper would he's not a chest pounder, but he would pound his chest until he was done on the stump in 2020 if this is something he can get through. And I think that's part of the reluctance from Republicans to send this thing forward. Anyway, we're getting off on a Medicaid tangent, but it's important.
But it is something that will not be in the budget, or at least not at this point, not the way the Democrats want it. So I want to go back to your original question. I don't want to duck it altogether, which is, you know, what jumps out at me about the budget. I mean, you know, in a way, just a day away from fairly significant demonstration by teachers in North Carolina, doctored photos notwithstanding. I don't know if you're planning on talking about that.
We might get to that. My Twitter feed's still active.
There was a sizable crowd of red-clad teachers again in Raleigh this week to lobby for more school funding, but also, in a way, an expanded platform, one that dovetails, consistently with the Democratic planks, and that is Medicaid expansion, increasing $15 an hour wage for wage earners and support staff at schools. But I think the Republicans, in a way, made it a little bit harder for the teachers and educators and people in that community to sound as desperate as maybe they did last year. That because the Republicans came out early before the rollout of the entire budget to say, hey, there's going to be a teacher pay increase. Now we're down to, I think, around 4.6% for teachers. Principals looking at a 10% pay raise. Probably one of the most important things is one of the provisions is the restoration of master's pay. This boost for teachers who earn master's pay. I mean, that was a big issue.
Big issue when it got revoked. And we hear about that a lot from educators.
Right. And so the Republicans came right out early this week and said, guess what we have in the budget? Yeah. So they as Representative Moore, the Speaker of the House, did, pointed to this being the fifth or sixth consecutive pay raise for teachers. Now, teachers will go back and say, we started way at the bottom. Right. We're just inching up. It's still not enough. And that's why you add in other important issues like Medicaid expansion and the boosting the hourly wage. But the Republicans put things in there that teachers had been paying for. Now, big question is that a response to the midterm election results? Is it a response to the second big demonstration by teachers?
Is it a proactive response to 2020 and what could be looming? Right. I mean, I think it's probably some from columns A, B, and C, and there are probably some other columns that we're not immediately addressing. Budgets and radio don't necessarily always go well together because there are so many numbers. But to touch on some of the numbers, average teacher raise would be 4.6%, and it would be in 2020. I'm going to come back to that in a moment. No raise for teachers with under 16 years of experience, and the starting pay would remain at $35,000 for educators in the state. That's not including the LEA supplements that exist in almost all, but can vary significantly, school districts. So some of those details that I just mentioned came later on Wednesday after the teachers had gone home, including the bit about when the raises would be effective. And I think this is an important note. Full disclosure, you and I are both state employees. We work for a university, and universities would, as I understand, well, at least under this budget, have some discretion as they've had in years past. Acknowledging that, the issue here is generally in recent years when you or and I, not just to be us, but any state employee has received a bump, a raise, it's retroactive to July 1st. Well, these raises would take effect on January 1st. So unsurprisingly, there have been plenty of critical comments about this budget from some of the groups that we would expect, but they have noted that this is effectively delaying raises for educators and state employees for 6 months, which is something that CNEC and NCAE and some of these groups have been quite upset about in the last 24 hours. So just, I mean, we're in the weeds a little bit, but that is an important thing to a lot of people who this budget does affect. some other budget things. I'm just going to tick off some here. Just throw a finger up if you want to jump in here at any point. And if you don't, I'm going to round back to something for you. There are tax cuts. Standard deduction is going to increase again to $20,750 for couples that are filing, married couples filing jointly. There's a reduction in the franchise tax down in 2019, down again in 2020. That's on the, you know, the revenue or the finance side. Then on the appropriation side, there's all sorts of stuff. You mentioned the restoration of the master's pay. There are raises for state employees. It would be 1% or $500, whichever is greater. Should note that CNIC called that proposal a slap in the face in an email where the subject said outrageous, that this budget is outrageous. There is a provision in this budget that seeks to ban teachers from using personal leave on normal school days so that they could participate in rallies like the one on Wednesday. Provision would require teachers to determine that in fact a substitute is available before getting approved time off. I want to hear from you on this, but I would only offer the question of, is this really policeable? They can put it in there, and if it maintains, it's certainly going to tick off a lot of educators. I don't know how you police something like this, though.
Right. It's pretty striking. I mean, that is, and I believe news of that provision, that line or few lines in the budget plan that would prohibit, basically prevent the kind of demonstrations we've now seen in two consecutive years from happening, came out kind of like right before this year's Red for Ed demonstration.
Right. I think it was late last week. I think we heard about that on Friday.
Right.
But just days ahead of it.
It's interesting. If you've read press releases from Senator Berger, President Pro Tem of the Senate, if you've read press releases from his office, I mean, and any Republican statement issued to the media, you see the word strike all the time. Unconstitutional gathering. They are calling this what they believe it clearly is, which is a walkout. I mean, these are people organizing against
constitution. You're not using the S word.
Violating, and the Republican press releases, I think, use it
They're
pretty liberally.
The
they use the word strike. But it's the teachers. It's hard to demonize, frankly, streets full of teachers and T-shirts with slogans that, like strong communities,
sure,
strong schools, teachers that have pretty compelling stories when you talk to each of them about the things they've done at personal expense to make sure their kids have school supplies, school nurse who tells you that, that we help healthier kids show up ready to sit in a seat all day, and as one with two children who find it hard to sit still, how important that is. I mean, they offer very compelling stories, and so it's striking the image you have from kind of Republican Party press releases Republican politician releases that kind of cast these people as basically violating constitutional prohibitions against organizing and striking, versus people who seem to be wanting to do what they think is right to express their beliefs. Does that make sense?
It does.
I'm not picking sides. I'm just saying it's hard to, if you just read some of the press release, some of the partisan press releases, you get one picture, and then you get a very different picture when you actually talk to people.
Right. And that, in a nutshell, is one of the challenges of our everyday job, is trying to sift through that and present the most balanced and accurate context to a lot of the rhetoric that comes out of this building. But this, to your point, this was a moment where the rhetoric gets even more cranked up. This far-left group, this dangerous group. I mean, I've covered a lot of protests in my life. You have, too. And worth noting, there were no arrests yesterday, at least that I saw or heard about. I mean, this was a calm, civil gathering. I mean, this isn't
including lots of kids, by the way.
Right.
There were lots of teachers or educators or supporters of that community who brought their kids out with red T-shirts to kind of observe and participate.
Couple of, I guess, just quick notes or observations from me, and I think you touched on this a moment ago. This would be the sixth consecutive year in which teachers would get a pay increase in some form or fashion. It's important to note that per pupil spending is still not up to pre-recession levels. Speaker Moore says that the average teacher salary would be, I think it's 55 and change, 55,000 and change, if this plan were to move forward, and that would put North Carolina right around the middle of the country. Right now, I believe the most recent data we have is 37th in the country. So there's a lot to chew on as it pertains to this. I'll be interested to see where, of course, specific to teacher raises in the budget, where it ends up, what the numbers end up being, the percent average percent increase, and also, you know, where the steps are. Is it for teachers that are, as it's presently the case, 16-year teacher, real veteran teachers, and longer and more experienced, or is the Senate going to offer up something different? And or when we reach the stalemate with the governor, how do these things get altered in the months to come? So,
and that's important too, the conversation about how do you get motivated, qualified teachers ready to live in a community for an extended amount of time to come to the state. And if it's top heavy and there's less incentive for people who are just coming out of Teach for America, but people
right,
coming
but
out of programs
and attainment. It's a balance and it's a challenging one, clearly. One other thing I'm going to just, I guess, note on the budget. Thought this was interesting that this came out of the budget were some controversial new taxes that would hit rideshare companies Lyft and Uber. Also some increased registration fees for individuals who own not only electric vehicles, like 100% electric vehicles like a Leaf, which exist, but also owners of Prii, if that's the correct plurality of Priuses.
Oh, gotcha.
Did you say Priuses? You see a lot more Toyota Priuses on the road than Nissan Leafs. So anyway, this is something that was controversial, and it actually came out of the budget. Again, that's not to say it can't go back in there, but Jason Sane, one of the lead budget writers, a Republican from Lincoln County, just he noted that there wasn't consensus on this, and they pulled it out, and I thought that was interesting.
It was, and I was at the committee debate on that on that bill, and the sponsor and the sponsor's identity and name is escaping me right now. But I remember, he was even saying that this was not a perfect response to the issue, but it's a start.
Yeah.
And then I believe the Democrats on the, because it was a Republican-backed bill, the Democrats on the committee acknowledged as much. It passed unanimously, and it was reported favorably by the committee unanimously. But the idea is that there's the number, each electric or plug-in hybrid vehicle mm-hmm. purchased or taken to the road means one gas guzzler basically being taken off.
Right.
And so the state's actually grappling with a significant enough drop off
right.
in the gas tax revenues.
Right.
Right now there's no solution, but I think a lot of people who support the idea of getting more of these right. fuel efficient vehicles, zero or low emission vehicles on the road are worried that this is maybe a draconian approach or approach that would discourage people.
Throwing you on the spot, I don't know the number. I mean, the flow of the money here is that when you and or I or anybody goes and fills up your tank, I think I paid $2.79 yesterday for a gallon of regular unleaded gas. It's like 35 cents a gallon maybe that's going in. To the gas tax, but that also funds bridges and roads across the state. We're talking about tens of millions of dollars a year, or is it more? Do you know?
Well, I don't know that figure,
okay.
but I can tell you that I do remember because it struck me as how small this number is.
Okay.
Under this, again, under the bill that is no longer a part of the budget
okay.
that was taken out
right.
with respect to the increased registration fees for electric and plug-in hybrid vehicles,
mm-hmm.
These would raise in the first year, we're talking about a little less than $500,000 to go into that highway trust fund.
Yeah, it's very little.
It's very little, they said, I think the sponsor said in the next fiscal year after that, it would be up to like $1.6 million.
Okay.
And so they see it rising. Hmm. Again, it's all proportional to how many people are getting these vehicles.
Rusty Jacobs here on the WUNC Politics Podcast. You can follow him on Twitter, Rusty Jacobs, WUNC. Here we are nearing 20 minutes already, and we haven't necessarily really gotten into some of the conversations that we had yesterday with folks at the Red for Ed rally. I also do want to chat about congressional elections here, special congressional elections here in a moment. But as it pertains to yesterday, it was, I think, as I noted a couple minutes ago, a civil group, a lively group. We did hear speeches from the governor, Roy Cooper, from Dr. William Barber, former head of the state NAACP. Didn't have any Republican speakers, unless one of them was Republican, and I'm not aware of that. But in some ways, it did feel like a partisan event. It was not particularly sharp in tone or tenor. I'm just giving some general reflections here. But I do think it's hard sometimes with these things, right, to say, you know, 6 months from now, oh, that rally back in May, it led to this. People ask me all the time, hey, what was the effect of the rally a year ago? And, you know, what really is going to happen because of this rally? And, like, there's a little bit of throwing the palms up because we don't know. We don't really know. It has an effect. I do believe that just based on how things play out, but I don't know what it is precisely.
Right. Depending on where you're coming from, it's either easy or difficult to draw a direct cause and effect connection between both last year's demonstration, this year's demonstration, and any responses from, let's say, the legislative majority or the legislative minority. I mean, there's no daylight between Democrats and the demonstrators, for the most part. I mean,
between Republicans and the demonstrators, or
no daylight in terms of the issues,
right?
I mean, in other words,
sorry, I got you. Yes.
Yeah, you know, Democrats at the very outset of this legislative session said Medicare expansion. That's what we want. Well, that's what the teachers are saying. Right. And teachers, by the way, I know we're really talking about a broader community of educators, supporters of that community, but teachers for shorthand, the people who were involved in the Red for Ed demonstration. And I asked many of them as I was walking down with the throngs from the NCAE headquarters to the legislature yesterday, you know, what effect do you think last year's demonstration had? And they said, well, look at the results of the midterm elections. The Democrats broke the supermajority in the legislature. We think this demonstration was instrumental in helping that happen. They'll also say that even the announcements from the Republican leadership this year about the budget, about what it does contain, about restoring master's pay, about getting 4-point-something percent increase for teachers, that they will draw a direct causal connection between their demonstrating and this happening.
You want to talk about this picture or not? Should we just move on? Chat about this picture briefly. Here's the brief context. The Halifax Mall behind on the north side of the legislature is a massive green sprawling area. It's a man-made area. There's actually a parking garage underneath. There were several of us out yesterday. I was not out there the entire time, but I took a series of pictures over the course of an hour. And, you know, all the educators come in. They're kind of spread out. They're spread across the green. And then they come in around this stage. They covered roughly, I would say, more than a third, less than a half of the Halifax Mall around this stage. Then this picture emerges on social media of the entire mall filled with people, and some, I'm not looking at it, but some caption about, congratulations, 38,000 people came today. I mean, that's garbage. It's BS. I won't use the words that I'm thinking, but, like, it's not a real picture. So the picture, I honestly don't even know where the picture originated. The biggest concern I had personally with seeing that picture is that the head of the NCAA retweeted it, and then he retweeted it again. And there's a lot of garbage and spin and falsehoods that are in and around this building, but that was a pretty egregious one to me to further disseminate. And now we're talking about it, and that's part of the issue, right?
Precisely. I on my own developed the impression that this was an impressive turnout, that it struck the right tone for the issues
Picture aside,
wanted to promote. And yeah, I had no idea until a conversation here in the press room arose, and I heard for the first time, and I saw I saw pictures compared, and it seemed clear that somebody had doctored a photo tried to make the turnout look a lot more impressive. It's perplexing because, on its own, I think for anybody who's in that community and wanted to promote greater funding for schools and more legislative support for education, had enough to go on with the issues and enough with the people who actually turned out. Doctored photos were unnecessary. And it's a self-defeating exercise to try to do anything other than rely on fact for conveying what happened in a particular place in a particular time.
Next topic, Tuesday night. Two doctors and a former mayor fared well in the 3rd Congressional District, Greg Murphy, North Carolina House Rep from Pitt County, and Joan Perry, a pediatrician, first-time political candidate, fared well in the Republican, a crowded Republican primary in the NC03 race. This is to replace the late Walter Jones, who passed away on his birthday back in February. There were 17 GOP candidates. These are the top two. They move on to a runoff on July the 9th. Murphy could have avoided a runoff had he received 30% of the vote. He didn't. He got, I'm not looking at it, about 23% of the vote. Perry got maybe 15% of the vote. So they move on. They'll face each other. It's going to be interesting to see how much of an establishment versus an outsider race this becomes, in my opinion, because Murphy has been here for a few years. He's the only or one of two physicians now in the legislature. He's really been a conservative champion of Medicaid. Don't call it Medicaid expansion, and also trying to combat the opioid crisis. Whereas Perry, it remains to be seen just how much she aligns herself with Trump. And as an outsider, she's very front and center, a pro-life candidate. That's a big issue for her, and I think we're going to hear more about that.
So it was a Democratic primary, too. Right?
There was a Democratic, yes. And the name there is Alan Thomas. And I was going to say, setting that one aside for a moment, just the Republicans in this race, this is a district that, what is the source here? The Cook, and I'm going to forget the name here, Cook Partisan Voting Index, has NC03 as an R+12. Trump won the district by about 20 points. So it's R. I mean, it's a Republican district. If there is a Democrat who has a chance, it could be Alan Thomas. He won the Democratic primary with just about 50% of the vote, former 3-term mayor of Greenville. And tip of the cap to Gary Robertson, colleague next door, Associated Press. He pointed out just the fact that Thomas has been on TV a lot in this district for a number of years. And, you know, you start to wonder if he can raise money well, if the Republicans beat up on each other in a primary runoff and Thomas can raise some cash and has some name ID and some face ID, could he, I mean, it'd have to be a really perfect storm, but could he make this thing competitive? I think there's a chance. I still think the winner on July 9th, either Murphy or Perry, probably wins then the special election on September 10th. But those are just some musings from the 3rd. Anything to jump in on that before we go to the 9th?
You know, just Walter Jones was known for being Walter Jones and not arch Republican, certainly not a Democrat. I mean, he was once upon a time a Democrat. But the point is that, you know, he was identified by his connection to that community, had a father who preceded him in office. So maybe a guy who has enough name recognition can transcend party labels. I mean, that's what Jones was known as, being a maverick or being someone who carved out a
real
niche for himself.
Of populism.
That's right. And could even... In the case of voting to authorize the Iraq War, could even go back and look at his own decisions and question, question the sensibility of those decisions. So, who knows what could happen? I mean, you said that Thomas is a three-time mayor,
former of Greenville,
which I'm guessing has a fair percentage of the electorate in that district.
No.
Oh, it doesn't.
It has some of Pitt County. It doesn't even have all of Pitt County. It has part of Greenville. Population centers include Kinston, New Bern, and Elizabeth City.
I think name recognition, though, could help anybody.
Yeah, for sure. So that's the 3rd. Listeners will remember the other open congressional seat in North Carolina is the 9th. That's because of a result that was never confirmed back in November when Mark Harris appeared to have defeated Dan McCready. Now we have Dan McCready back in the race versus a slew of Republicans. Primary on this one is May 14th, I do believe. You've been following this race. You're working on another story. Just give us a little update. Where are things in the 9th?
So 10 Republicans.
Okay.
Well, I should say 9 Republicans
and
a 10th candidate that Republicans say is not a Republican. Right. And that's Chris Anglin, who, as many people will remember, ran for North Carolina Supreme Court in what was a three-way race between Barbara Jackson, the incumbent at the time, Republican, and Democrat Anita Earls. Chris Anglin entered as a Republican and really used a loophole that was created by Republican-backed legislation and was able to re-register and then run in the race as a Republican. He says he was doing it on principle, that he believes Republicans need somebody who's going to support the Constitution, and he wanted to give people a choice, but the Republican Party labeled him as a fraud and a Democratic plant. And it should be noted that a Wake County Superior Court judge ruled this week that Anglin has no case. He wanted the courts to intervene and force the Republican Party to invite him to debates and to give him access to voter data. But that didn't happen. Nonetheless, he is the 10th person or one of the 10 people in the Republican primary. There is no Democratic primary. Dan McCready, well-funded, running unopposed.
Right.
There is a Libertarian, Jeff Scott, and Alan Smith, I believe, is is the Green Party candidate.
Saw a tweet this afternoon from Jim Morrill of Charlotte Observer, who said Dan McCready has raised $2.7 million, I believe, in the quarter and has $1.5 million on hand, just for whatever that's worth. And one follow-up on Anglin. I do think from a precedent standpoint, this is probably a good thing. I'm not a lawyer. However, can you imagine Dallas Woodhouse challenging Roy Cooper in a 2020 Democratic primary? Like, at some point, like, let's just roll back the trolling, right? I mean, you got to put limits on some of this stuff. All right, Rusty Jacobs here on the Politics Podcast. We've been rambling for a while. Various and sundry portion of the afternoon gala here before you get on your way. Not to out you, but totally outing you. You grew up an Islanders fan. How closely are you watching this Hurricanes New York Islanders series?
Not terribly. Well, I've been checking the headlines, and I know that the Canes won a third.
You don't have like any bets with friends.
No, okay. Look, I lived as a pre-adolescent through the Islanders dynasty. I saw them win four consecutive Stanley Cups, and it was exciting. And I even played little league hockey at the time. But it's not my favorite sport as a spectator. I've been to a few Canes games. Actually, when I first moved to North Carolina to be a reporter at WUNC, I covered the playoffs when the Canes went on to lose. I think it was against Detroit. It was their first
Eastern Conference finals.
Yeah.
Was it before the cup or after?
No, I believe they made it to the finals. I didn't report on the finals, but I reported on a series against the Toronto Maple Leafs. Just one game, nonetheless. But I am a sports fan.
Yeah.
And
it's exciting.
As a sports fan, you cannot deny the excitement of a team that just eked into the playoffs.
Oh, right? Yeah.
That just clawed their way into the playoffs to turn around and take out the defending champions with Ovechkin. I mean, listen, like I said, I know a little bit about a lot of sports.
Yeah, yeah.
I know who Ovechkin is.
Yeah.
All right. Great player. One of the best of all time, perhaps, but certainly a great player. And a team defending its... and the Canes come out.
Right. They won Game 7 on the road, which I just thought was... I'm a casual, at best, hockey observer. But that first-round series against the Caps, the home team won all first six games, and then the Canes go in and win in D.C., which I thought was neat.
So, I don't know who plays on the Islanders anymore. It's been a long time, you know. And they play in Brooklyn now. Actually, I love Brooklyn. My mom's from Brooklyn. But what I'm saying is I don't have a real strong identity. As a fan, I both find it unbelievable and exciting that the Canes are now up 3-0. And I want to see them keep rolling.
Canes get the winner of Columbus or Boston. I'm a Boston guy. Again, casual hockey fan. Some people have had two careers. By my count, you're on your fourth career, also your second. Here's how
and we're not even counting stints as a doorman, as a bellman at a hotel in Midtown Manhattan.
I'm not counting that as a career. Those are more jobs.
And I drove a cab.
So you were in radio, then you were an attorney. You're back, obviously, now as a journalist after working in the Wake County District Attorney's Office. But before all that, you were an actor. What are the best and worst parts about no longer being on stage in front of the camera?
Well, I'm still a glutton for attention.
Okay.
So I get that you know, a little bit in my radio career, but I love facing an audience. I love theater. I love working in the theater. I still have friends. Okay. You know, I have a friend who's still pursuing an acting career out in Los Angeles, and I often think to myself, you know, maybe if my wife puts away enough, maybe she could bankroll my return to the to an acting career.
What's the best part about being away?
Best part of
being away from acting.
Well, heartache.
If there is, okay.
I mean, listen. There's a reason I'm not an actor anymore. I tried it into my adulthood. I used up all my luck and talent as a kid. I mean, I was a professional actor as a child, adolescent.
Right.
When I returned to it as a young adult, after I left college early, I went back. I have my degree. Don't worry. But you know, when I left to resume pursuing an acting career, it didn't go as well. Now, that's not to say there wasn't joy. I took acting classes. I enjoyed the craft of acting and becoming a better actor. And I was in a theater troupe in Lower Manhattan, and it was rewarding and gratifying as an artist, but it didn't pay any bills.
Right.
And those were the years where I waited tables. I was a doorman. I was a bellman, and I never lasted at those jobs because, frankly, I'm really not cut out for the service industry.
Yeah.
So that's what I don't miss. I don't miss spending a lot of time thinking how long do I have to do this before something good happens, and how long can I take it?
I wasn't going to ask you this, but sometimes one question leads into another. Most famous person you ever drove in a cab, if you ever had a good one. It's New York, so
I've got interesting people, but I can tell you the most two famous people. Famous, we're using that term loosely. I'll give you three encounters.
Okay.
All of them happened when I was working at the Helmsley Windsor Hotel, little business hotel in Midtown Manhattan, owned by Leona Helmsley, the Queen of Mean. I don't know if you remember her famous character from tabloid headlines.
I don't.
In New York City.
Honest. Okay.
When I was a bellhop, Armand DeSante, you'll have to look him up. He's a well-known character actor, was staying at the hotel, and I just happened to keep a stack of headshots of mine, photos in my locker at work in case I should ever run into someone who might be in a position to help my career. I slipped my headshot underneath his hotel room door, and when he was leaving the next morning, he stopped by my bell desk and looked at me and he goes, I got your photo. And that was about it. Didn't say. Norman Fell, you remember Three's Company?
Yeah.
Norman Fell was Mr. Roper. And he's also a character actor. He was in The Graduate. I mean, he's well-known character actor. I was working the door that day when he arrived at the Windsor Hotel, and I was getting people in, taking them from the cabs, taking their bags. Norman Fell, clearly recognizable. I grab his bag, open the door, lead him to the elevator. You know, I put his bag on a cart. The bellman takes over, and I kind of stand there for one awkward moment in which he gave me no money. So Norman Fell stiffed me. And the last anecdote I'll give you is I was working the door again one night. Two people are coming walking down the street. One of them is a pretty tall guy. And as he approaches, he goes, he kind of does a double take, and he looks at me, and he comes closer, and he goes, I think I know you. And I look up at him, and I clearly know him. It's Danny Aiello, who's another character actor, was in a movie that I did called Once Upon a Time in America.
Okay.
Do the Right Thing. He was the pizza owner. He owned the pizza shop.
Yeah, the Spike Lee joint.
That's right.
Yeah, okay.
A big part in, Moonstruck with Cher. Yeah. Anyway, very well-known character actor. Yeah. Also happened to be on Broadway in 1979 in a show called Knockout. I was in a show called Peter Pan, which was on Broadway at the time.
Yeah.
And I used to see him all the time at Sardi's, this theater district restaurant we used to eat at between shows, between matinees and evening shows. Anyway, Dan Aiello is walking with his manager and sees me and recognizes me and says, Rusty, right? I said, yeah, Danny. He turns to this guy who turns out to be his manager. Goes, this kid's great. Goes, what are you doing in a doorman costume? And I was like, I'm looking for my next acting gig.
Right.
And so he says, you got a headshot. So I go, I run down, I give my photo, and I give it to his manager. Nothing happened. He was shooting a movie down the street. He said, come by the next day. I'm in a trailer on 57th Street. Come, stop by, say hello. And I did, and it was very nice. For a day and a half, reinflated my ego,
sure.
But it led to nothing.
Gives you a boost, nonetheless.
On Twitter, Rusty Jacobs, WNC. You can find Rusty's work, links to it, and hear his voice and some of his other stories about the 9th congressional race and many other political happenings at our website, WUNC.org. Rusty, enjoyed it. Thanks for coming back on the podcast.
You're welcome.
Always glad to have you tuning in. You can subscribe to the program, leave us a review or a comment if you are so inclined on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, wherever it is that you get that on-demand listening. The budget we expect to be approved by Friday, and there'll be much more to come in North Carolina politics in the days and weeks to come. So thanks, as always, for listening, and we will talk to you again next week. For Rusty Jacobs, I'm Jeff Tiberi. No one else was in the room where it happened, the room where it happened, the room where it happened. No one else was in the room where it happened, the room where it happened, the room where it happened. No one really knows how the game is played, the art of the trade, how the sausage gets made. We just assume that it happens, but no one else is in the room where it happens.